From the macabre minds of Laughing Devil Production comes another story from the Nightshade Diary. You know what that means. Check under the bed and make sure no one or nothing is there. Is the closet door securely shut? Then leave your disbelief behind, amp up your imagination, and hang on tight for another ride into terror and mystery. And like all good horror stories, just imagine it's a dark and stormy night. And remember, screaming like a little girl is permitted.
The Hindu Child. I met Nurse Mackenzie for the first time at the house of my old friend, Colonel Malcolmson, whose wife she was nursing. For some days I was hardly aware she was in the house, the illness of her patient keeping her so occupied. But when Mrs. Malcolmson grew better, I not infrequently saw the nurse taking a morning constitutional in the beautiful grounds. It was on one of these occasions that we fell to talking about ghosts, and she told me of her own uncanny experience some 10 years earlier, at the turn of the century. "It happened," she began, "shortly after I had finished my term as probationer in an Aberdeen hospital. A letter was received at the hospital one morning with the urgent request that two nurses should be sent to a serious case near St. Swithin Street. As the letter was signed by a well-known physician in the town, it received immediate attention, and Nurse Emmett and I were sent as day and night nurses, respectively, to deal with the emergency. My tour of duty was to be from 9 p.m. till 9 a.m. The house in which the patient was located was known as the White Dove Hotel, a thoroughly respectable and well-managed establishment. The proprietor knew nothing about the invalid except that her name was Vining, and that she had at one period of her career been an actress. He had noticed that she looked unwell on her arrival the previous week. 2 days after her arrival, she had complained of feeling very ill, and the doctor summoned to attend her diagnosed that she was suffering from an aggravating disease of Oriental origin, one fortunately rare in this country. The hotel, though newly decorated and equipped, was in reality very old. It was one of those delightfully roomy erections that seemed built for eternity rather than time, and for comfort rather than economy of space. The interior, with its oak-paneled walls, polished oak floors, and low ceilings, impressed me pleasantly, while a flight of broad oak stairs, fenced with balustrades a foot thick, brought me to a seemingly interminable corridor to which the door of Miss Vining's room opened. It was a low, wainscoted apartment, and its deep-set window, revealing the thickness of the wall, looked out upon a yard littered with brooms and buckets. Opposite the foot of the bed, a modern French bedstead, whose brass fittings and filmy hangings contrasted strangely with their venerable surroundings, was an ingle containing the moldering relics of what had doubtless been intended for a fire. There was no exit save by the doorway I had entered, and no furniture except a couple of rush-bottomed chairs and a table strewn with an untidy collection of writing materials and medicine bottles. A feeling of depression seized me directly I entered the room. Despite the brilliancy of the electric light and the new and gaudy bed hangings, the air was full of gloom. I felt it hanging around me like the undeveloped shadow of something singularly repulsive, and on my approaching the sick woman, it seemed to thrust itself in my way and force me back. Miss Vining was decidedly good-looking. She had typically theatrical features, neatly molded nose and chin, curly yellow hair and big, dreamy blue eyes. She was, of course, far too ill to converse, and beyond a few desultory remarks, maintained a rigid silence. As there was no occasion for me to sit close beside her, I drew up a chair before the fire, placing myself in such a position as to command a full view of the bed. My first night passed undisturbed by any incident, and in the morning the condition of my patient showed a slight improvement. It was soon after 8 o'clock in the evening when I came on duty again, and the weather having changed during the day, the whole room echoed and re-echoed with the howling of the wind which raged round the house. I had been at my post for a little over 2 hours, and had just registered my patient's temperature, when, happening to look up from the book I was reading, I saw to my surprise that the chair beside the head of the bed was occupied by a child, a tiny girl. How she had come into the room without attracting my attention was extraordinary, and I could only suppose that the shrieking of the wind down the chimney had deadened the sound of the door and her footsteps. I was naturally very indignant that she had dared to come in without knocking, and getting up from my seat, I was preparing to address her and bid her go, when she lifted a small white hand and motioned me back. I obeyed because I could not help myself. Her action was accompanied by a peculiar expression that held me spellbound, and without exactly knowing why, I stood staring at her, tongue-tied and trembling. As her face was turned towards the patient, and she wore a very wide-brimmed hat, I could see nothing of her features, but from her graceful little figure and dainty limbs, I gathered that she was probably both beautiful and aristocratic. Her dress, though not perhaps of the richest quality, was certainly far from shoddy, and there was something in its style that made me or suggested foreign nationality. I was so taken up with watching her that I forgot all about my patient, until a prolonged sigh from the bed reminded me of her existence. With an effort, I then advanced and was about to approach the bed, when the child, without moving her head, motioned me back to my chair, and again I was helpless. The vision I had obtained of the sick woman, brief though it was, filled me with alarm. She was tossing to and fro on the blankets and breathing in the most agonized manner, as if in delirium, or in the grip of some particularly dreadful nightmare. Her condition so frightened me that I made the most frantic efforts to get to her side. I did not succeed, however, and at last, utterly overcome by my exertions, I closed my eyes. When I opened them again, the chair by the bed was vacant. The child had gone. A tremendous feeling of relief surged through me, and jumping out of my seat, I hastened to the bedside. My patient was worse. The fever had increased, and she was delirious. I took her temperature. It was 104. I now sat close beside her, and my presence apparently had a soothing effect. She speedily grew calmer, and after taking her medicine, gradually sank into a gentle sleep, which lasted until late in the morning. When I left her side, she had altogether recovered from the relapse. I naturally told the doctor of the child's visit, and he was very angry. "Whatever happens, nurse," he said, "take care that no one enters the room tonight. The patient's condition is far too critical for her to see anyone. You must keep the door locked." Armed with this mandate, I went on duty the following night, with a somewhat lighter heart, and after locking the door, once again sat by the fire. During the day there had been a heavy fall of snow, the wind had abated, and the streets were now as silent as the grave. 10, 11, and 12 o'clock struck, and my patient slept tranquilly. At 1:45, however, I was abruptly aroused from a reverie by a sob of fear and agony that came from the bed. I looked across, and there, seated in the same posture as on the previous evening, was the child. I sprang to my feet with a cry of amazement. She raised her hand, and as before, I collapsed back into my seat, paralyzed. No words of mine can convey all the sensations I experienced as I sat there, forced to listen to the moaning and groaning of the woman whose fate had been entrusted to my keeping. Every second, she grew worse, and each sound rang in my ears like the hammering of nails in her coffin. How long I endured such torment, I cannot say, for though the clock was within a few feet of me, I never once thought of looking at it. At last the child rose, and moving slowly from the bed, advanced with bowed head towards the window. The spell was broken. With an angry cry, I literally bounded over the carpet and faced the intruder. "Who are you?" I hissed. "Tell me your name instantly. How dare you enter this room without my permission?" As I spoke, she slowly raised her head. I snatched at her hat. It melted away in my hands. And to my unspeakable hot terror, I looked into the face of a corpse. The corpse of a Hindu child, with a big gaping cut in her throat. In her lifetime, the child had without doubt been lovely. She was not horrible with all the ghastly disfigurements, the repellent disfigurements of a long consignment to the grave. I promptly fainted. On recovering, I found that my ghostly visitor had vanished, and that my patient was dead. One of her hands was thrown across her eyes, as if to shut out some object on which she feared to look, while the other grasped the counterpane convulsively. It fell to my duty to help pack up Miss Vining's belongings, and among her letters was a large envelope bearing the postmark Quetta. As we were then on the lookout for some clue as to the address of our relatives, I opened it. It was merely the cabinet-sized photograph of a Hindu child, but I recognized the dress immediately. It was that of my ghostly visitor. On the back of it were these words, "Natalie, may God forgive us both." Though we made careful inquiries for any information as to Natalie and Miss Vining and Quetta, and advertised freely in the leading London papers, we learned nothing, and in time we were forced to let the matter drop. As far as I know, the ghost of the Hindu child has never been seen again, but I have heard that the hotel is still haunted by a woman. Phantoms from my notebook. Glancing through one of my notebooks, I see the date July 24th, 1898. It is a date I am not likely to forget, and this is the story of it from my penciled notes. It was a Sunday, and my rambles that evening took me into Greenwich Park. It was warm and close, the sun still lingering in the west, while the sky in the east was clear and cloudless. Leaving the carriage drive to the left, I stepped onto the grassy walk, and making my way past a score or so of strolling couples, eventually found myself in a narrow avenue composed of magnificent elm trees. The shade here being so pleasant after the heat of the open park, I looked around for a seat, and discovering one, sat down to idle away an hour or so. Just beneath where I was sitting was a gap in the foliage, through which I had a panoramic view of undulating banks of sun-baked yellow-green turf, beyond which lay a sea of smoking chimneys, of dingy, inhospitable-looking buildings, of slender, lofty masts, and the glistening, winding Thames, now impressively deserted. I could appreciate all this just then, as my holidays, shortly to begin, when I should be free for a while from the monotony of school teaching and able to concentrate on my efforts to write. The bench on which I sat was directly beneath a giant elm, the base of which afforded an ideal backrest. I was accordingly leaning against its trunk when a sudden icy cold wind blowing from above made me glance up. I then noticed that the bark of the tree was not only disfigured, but unsightly notches and protuberant gnarls, but bore indications of some malignant parasitical disease. Kneeling on the seat to inspect it more closely, I was examining the trunk with interest when a dark object seemed to descend from above and something came plump by my side. I have never been able to describe the awful shock I received when, on turning around to see what it was, my eyes alighted on a figure half human and half animal, stunted, bloated, pulpy and yellow. Crawling sideways like a crab, it made for a bush opposite into which it disappeared. I did not wait to see whether it would return, but jumping hurriedly from the seat, made tracks for the school, not visiting the park again till the following autumn, when I took care to give that tree a very wide berth. It was obviously just a common elemental or nature spirit, but I don't think any occult manifestation has ever filled me with such unutterable loathing, nor so effectually damped all desire of further investigations. Some further excerpts from my notebooks may be of interest to the reader, showing as they do the ramifications of a ghost hunter's activities. Here, for instance, are brief notes of two odd little hauntings in London which I was unable to follow up. The first came to me from a woman who told me that the house she had recently lived in at Wandsworth was haunted. Day after day, said my informant, she had been disturbed by an old woman who used to chatter outside her bedroom door. She grew so accustomed to the noise that she was not in the least bit nervous and used to call out to the ghost and bid it to be silent, an injunction it sometimes obeyed. Both my informant and her sister often saw the old woman in various parts of the house, generally on the staircase or flitting about the passages, but she was so entirely harmless and natural that no one paid her much attention. The second haunting, again described to me by a witness, concerned a thoroughly modern ghost. In a house close to Ealing Broadway, a woman who spent most of her evenings at London nightclubs dancing died. The night after her funeral, sounds of gay music and dancing were heard coming from the room in which she had breathed her last, and the sounds continued to be heard there periodically. Ghostly music apparently does not affect all animals in the same way. for whereas the dead woman's cat, a large tabby, always ran upstairs directly the sounds commenced, and sat on the doormat outside the room, apparently listening with great eagerness to the music and dancing, a dog in the same house immediately began to bark and howl in terror. Turning the pages again, here is my note of a house I investigated in Whitechapel. An unusual noise haunting, this one. Hearing that I was interested in ghosts, a man named Andrews, a clerk, told me that the house where he was lodging in Commercial Road was haunted, and that he would be glad if I would sit up with him one night and investigate the haunting. When I agreed, he said, "I won't tell you beforehand what happens, because then what you experience can't be put down to suggestion." The night chosen by me for the investigation was in March, and the weather was bitterly cold. There was absolutely nothing ghostly about the house. It was just a very uninteresting, small, and comparatively modern building, crammed full of shoddy furniture and reeking of fried fish and a variety of other living and cooking smells. Mr. Andrews' room was on the first floor, and after everyone in the place had retired to bed, we opened the door of his room and sat facing the little landing. After we had been sitting there for about an hour in absolute silence, we did not talk, not wishing to disturb other people in the house. I was suddenly conscious of an eerie feeling, and immediately afterwards I heard a jingling and tinkling sound, such as is made by the small bells on a child's harness, and following that, a sound that seemed to have been made by a rubber ball, hitting the wall opposite and landing back onto the floor beside me. Andrews immediately lit the gas, but nothing was to be seen. When he had closed the door of the room, he said, "You heard those sounds. Well, we all hear them every night. They always occur about the same time, and although we are trying hard to find some natural explanation for them, so far we have failed." I was not surprised. A repetition of this experience on several subsequent nights strengthened and confirmed my impression that the strange sounds owe their origin to supernatural behavior. I think I've made it clear that a number of my investigations of alleged haunted houses have produced no result, but that where only one night sitting can be made, it really is too much to expect everything to happen at once, or anything at all. For various reasons, some of my inquiries have been thus restricted to a single vigil, with negative results. Such was the case with a house in Clifton, Bristol, but the very nature of the haunting, as recorded in my notebook, calls for mention here. Lord Curzon, who several times accompanied me most enthusiastically on my investigations, insisted on my taking him to this empty house, which had long borne the reputation for being haunted. It was in a terrace not far from the suspension bridge and dated back to about 1780. The hauntings, however, did not break out until during the last occupier's tenancy. What happened was this. Before taking the house, the last tenant, on going to view it one day, saw a woman dressed in black standing in one of the rooms. She had her back to him and, obviously unaware of his presence, was arranging her hair under her hat, thinking she must be some prospective tenant, like himself, come to see over the house. He was about to make his presence known when, to his astonishment, she vanished. Being a very matter-of-fact practical man, not at all superstitious, he thought it strange, but concluded that he had been the victim of some peculiar kind of illusion. He dismissed the matter from his mind, and continuing his survey of the house, eventually took it. He and his family had not been in it long, however, before his encounter with a lady in black was vividly recalled to him by certain weird happenings. One evening his wife and little boy and the wife's sister heard a strange, ominous cry. It seemed to pass right through the room, leaving them considerably startled. On another occasion, the same boy and his brother saw a woman in black holding a small boy by the hand, standing in the doorway staring at them. They yelled out, and on their mother running upstairs to see what was the matter, the woman and boy disappeared. From the description the two children gave of the woman, it was apparently the same figure their father had seen when looking over the house. She was dressed in black and presented the appearance of just a very ordinary modern woman. But there were other more remarkable phenomena. For instance, every night at about the same time, footsteps were heard running upstairs from the hall to the landing on the first floor. Sounds like the winding of a big clock were next heard, and when these sounds ceased, the footsteps recommenced and were heard ascending the stairs to the next floor. Arriving there, they ran across the landing to the bathroom, the door of which was heard to open and shut, and then started bounding about on the floor, once a hospital nurse staying in the house, hearing what she thought was a clock on the landing being wound up and wondering who could be doing such a thing at such an hour, after everyone had gone to bed, opened the door of her room and looked out. What she saw gave her a shock. A strange-looking shadowy figure was in the act of climbing the staircase leading to the floor immediately overhead. Its back being towards her, she could not see its face, but the thing as a whole gave her the impression that it was very evil and grotesque, more like some huge, horrible ape than a human being. It went up the stairs, two or three at a time, and she heard it open and shut the bathroom door and then bound about all over the floor. In the daytime, too, the phenomena continued. Footsteps accompanied by heavy breathing were heard ascending the stone steps leading from the cellar to the passage on the ground floor between the morning room and the kitchen. On one or two occasions, an indistinct shadowy form, which may have been the same thing the nurse saw, was seen to rush along the passage and disappear in the kitchen. At other times, a voice called out, "Henry!" was heard proceeding, apparently from the chimney in one of the rooms. There may have been other phenomena, but this is all I noted down. The incidents were related to me by the man who took the house, his wife and sister-in-law. It was because the case was so well attested and so well known in Clifton at the time that Lord Curzon chose it for our investigation. The house certainly looked haunted. It was in a most forlorn and dilapidated condition, being untenanted for some years. The paper in some of the rooms was dropping from the walls. Cobwebs festooned the ceilings, window panes were broken, and doors and floorings were covered in places with huge, repulsive-looking fungi. We sat waiting on camp stools at the head of the cellar steps, but nothing occurred. As Lord Curzon was too tired to sit up any longer, we came away soon after 1 o'clock with regrets, but not, I might add, without considerable relief. In an earlier notebook, I see I have some notes on family ghosts, and particularly those relating to Scotland. Much has been written of the phantom drummer of Cortachy, who was invariably heard playing his drum, sometimes to the accompaniment of ghostly pipes, before the death of a member of the Ogilvy family. There's quite a lot of corroborated evidence on the subject of the Ogilvy family ghost, and I was told years ago, on my first visit to Scotland, that the Ogilvys themselves still firmly believed in it. The family of Grant Rothmuchus were haunted by the Bodach Adon, the Kinchardines by the Lamdurg, or Spectre of the Bloody Hand, and the Tulloch Gorms by May Mulloch, or the Girl with a Hairy Hand. All these are families of distinction, and according to the popular idea, it is only families or clans of distinction that possesses family ghosts. Such an idea, however, is quite wrong. There are many ordinary families in the west of Scotland and in the western isles that have been haunted for long centuries by spirits of the Gleisteague species, in effect a sort of Scottish banshee, as well as by the spirits of the dead and the more harrowing and alarming types of elementals. On my second visit to Scotland, I stayed with an old school friend, Charlie Campbell, in Argyll. He was a keen sportsman, as I was then, and it was arranged that we should fish one night on Loch Fyne. When the time came for us to set out, however, Campbell was taken ill and could not go, so at his suggestion, I set off without him, accompanied by one of his outdoor servants, a rugged, dour-looking Western Islander named Neil MacPherson. The night, though very fine and still was dark, and ours appeared to be the only boat out. There were plenty of whales, however, and when we had gone some little distance from the shore, they began spouting in closer proximity to our boat, so I thought then was altogether pleasant, although MacPherson assured me they were quite small and absolutely harmless. We were fishing at anchorage in absolute silence, when quite suddenly I caught the far-off sound of oars. "Who can they be?" I asked MacPherson, more for the sake of hearing myself speak than for anything else, for we had been sitting in silence for a long time. "Fishermen?" "I dinna ken yon, sir," MacPherson replied, and I thought I detected a trace of anxiety in his voice. The sound came from the rear. I was sitting facing the bow of the boat, and as the oars drew nearer, I turned around, but could see nothing in the darkness. "Oughtn't they to carry a light?" I asked. MacPherson did not answer. The sounds drew nearer still. I could hear the splashing of the water each time the blades of the oars struck it, and the grating of the handles of the oars as they moved to and fro in the rowlocks, but still I could see nothing. On the boat came, and as it passed by us, so close that its oars seemed but a foot or two from our gunwales. I was puzzled by the silence of the rowers. There appeared to be several, none of whom uttered a sound. The silence was extraordinary, as in my experience boatmen, be they fishermen or ordinary sailors, invariably talk. The night being so still, I could hear the sound of the oars for some time after the boat had passed, and it was not until the sound had died away to be replaced by the familiar spasmodic spouting of the whales that I spoke to MacPherson. "Shall we try somewhere else?" I asked. "It doesn't seem much use staying here. I haven't had as much as a bite." "You will forgive me, sir," he replied, "if I suggest we go home now." "Aren't you feeling well?" I said, for there was a tremor in his voice. "Not very well, sir," he answered shortly. "All right," I said, "we'll go." Then before I was really conscious of what I was saying, I added, "It isn't anything to do with that boat that passed us, is it?" "Yes, sir," he answered solemnly. "That was the death boat. It has haunted our family for hundreds of years, and is never seen or heard, saving before the death of one of us. We all heard it the night before my father was drowned off Portree in the island of Skye, and again just before the death of my youngest sister. I dread tomorrow, because I am sure I shall get word that my brother Angus is dead." I tried to calm him. "Surely, Neil," I said, "you could be mistaken. You didn't see your brother, did you?" "Yes," he replied, endeavoring to steady his voice, "I did. There were four rowers, there are always four, dressed in black, and Angus, my brother, dressed just like them, was sitting in the stern. It is he who is dead." The sense of finality accompanying this statement seemed to make any further discussion of the subject useless. So after a pause, I turned our talk onto another channel. MacPherson's fears, however, proved to be correct, for at noon the next day he received a telegram from his mother saying that Angus had been caught in a sudden squall and drowned. While on this subject, I ought to make brief reference to the phantom ship that has from time to time visited St. Ives Bay in Cornwall. A fisherman who sometimes took me out in his boat was once called upon to go to the rescue of a ship that had been burning lights as a signal for help to the westward of St. Ives Head. He and his comrades said put off, and when they drew nearer to the vessel, they saw to her astonishment that her masts and riggings were covered with ice, as if she had encountered Arctic weather. Also, no one was visible on deck, and when they hailed her, there was no reply. This struck them as being very odd, but stranger things were to follow, for when the man in the bows of the St. Ives boat stood up and tried to clutch hold of the bulwarks of the strange vessel, the latter suddenly and inexplicably vanished. The St. Ives man would have fallen into the sea had he not been held by one of his mates. The men now realized that what they had seen was a famous phantom ship, and they lost no time in getting back to harbor. A few hours later, a great storm arose, and a ship was wrecked at Gwythion, everyone on board perishing. According to my fisherman friend, the phantom ship is seldom, if ever, seen in St. Ives Bay, save before some local maritime disaster. Now, 'twas summer's day in 1900, and my record of a very unusual animal ghost. I was visiting the London Zoo on this day, and was so struck by the look in the eyes of one of the lions, which seemed to me to be the desperate look of yearning to have just 5 minutes on the sunny lawn to stretch its cramped up limbs, that I could not help passing a remark to this effect to a white-haired old man and plainly dressed young woman who stood next to me. "Yes," the old man said, "it does seem hard on these huge animals to have to pace up and down these little boxes, tantalized by the sight of other creatures enjoying the privileges that are denied to them. But they have one thing to be thankful for. There's a paradise waiting for all these creatures, just as there is for the lucky ones among us." "You believe in animals having spirits?" I asked. "Yes, spirits. Ghosts, if you like," he said emphatically. "I've seen plenty of proof of it." He then stopped himself, feeling he had probably said too much, but I encouraged him to go on. He looked at me searchingly and then said, "I used to be a keeper here some years ago. I was devoted to the animals, and when they died, I often saw their ghosts So did some of the other keepers. But don't run away with the idea that the zoo is haunted. It was only to us, who had so much to do with them when they were alive, that the spirits of these animals appeared. I remember one instance in particular about 12 years ago, just before I left the zoo. A young lion came here from East Africa. It wouldn't let any of the keepers go near it except myself, and it was generally regarded as having a very uncertain temper. But I never found it so. I knew the reason for its restlessness was its hatred of confinement. I knew it hated its cage, and I used to do all I could to comfort it. There was a sort of mutual understanding between us. When it saw me looking a bit anxious and worried, for my wife was often ill, it used to come and rub its great head against me, as if to cheer me up. And when I saw it looking more than usually dejected, I used to stop and talk to it for a longer time than I talked to any of the other animals. One day, it fell ill, caught a chill, so we thought, and went off its food. I discussed in the case with other keepers, and they agreed there was nothing to be alarmed about, as it was young and to all appearances healthy. We all thought it would be well again in a few days, so I wasn't unduly worried. Well, I had gone home as usual one night, and was sitting in the kitchen reading the evening paper, when something came over me that I must go for a walk. I told my granddaughter, Mary, here. She was a little girl then, not more than 9 or 10, and she begged her mother to let her go with me. We started off with the intention of going to the Caledonian Road, as Mary liked looking at the shops there, but we hadn't gone far before she suddenly said, "Granddad, let's go to Regent's Park." "Regent's Park," I said. "Whatever do you want to go there for at this time of night?" "I don't know," she said, "but I feel I must." "Well, now," I admitted, "that's odd, because the very same feeling has come over me." We struck off down Crowndale Road. I was living in the neighborhood of the St. Pancras Road then, and got to Gloucester Gate just about dusk. We had passed through and were walking along the broad walk by the side of the zoo, when Mary suddenly caught hold of my arm and said, "Look, Granddad." I followed the direction of her gaze, and there, coming straight towards us from the zoo walls, was a lion. I can tell you it gave me a jump, as I naturally thought one of the animals had escaped. It aimed straight for us, and on its getting close to, I recognized it at once. It was the young lion that had been taken ill. To my astonishment, however, there was nothing of the invalid about it now. The expression in its eyes was one of great happiness. It came right up to us, and I stretched out my hand to touch it, wondering what the passerbys would do when they saw it, and how on earth we should get it back into the gardens. It grieved me to think it would have to lose its freedom again. I stretched out my hand to touch it, and to my surprise, my fingers encountered nothing. The lion had vanished. I then realized what Mary had known all along, that what we had seen was a ghost, and yet it had been so absolutely real and lifelike. I turned to the old man's granddaughter. "How did you know it was a ghost?" I asked her. "By the curious light that seemed to come from all over its body," she said, "a kind of glow. It was not a bit natural." "But you saw the figure distinctly?" "Yes, very distinctly, and I wasn't the least bit afraid." "Let me tell you the sequel," her grandfather continued. "On my arrival at the zoo in the morning, one of the men came running up to me. 'It's dead,' he said." "What's dead?" I said. "Why, that young lion of yours," he said. "It died last night." When I went into the lion house, there was the poor animal lying stretched out full length. It had died at 8 o'clock the previous night, I was told, which was the exact time we had seen it in the park. The ghost of animals also figured in two unusual hauntings, which I noted as fully as possible from inquiries, but which, because of the passage of time, I could not personally investigate. They are, in fact, among a handful of absorbing cases which I would have greatly liked to pursue. First, a case from Hampshire. The sister of a well-known author told me there used to be a house called the Swallows, standing in 2 acres of land close to a village near Basingstoke. In 1840, a Mr. Bishop from Tring bought the house, which had long stood empty, and moved into it the following year. But after he had been only a fortnight in occupation, two servants gave notice to leave, swearing that the place was haunted by a large cat and a big baboon, which they constantly saw stealing down the staircases and passages. They also testified to hearing sounds as of somebody being strangled, coming from an empty attic near where they slept, and hearing the screams and groans of a number of people being horribly tortured in the cellars just underneath the dairy. When they went down to see the cause of the disturbances, nothing was ever visible. In a matter of days, other members of the household began to be harassed by similar manifestations. The news spread quickly through the village, and crowds of people came to the house at night with lights and sticks to see if they could witness anything. One night, at about midnight, when several of the watchers were stationed on guard in the empty courtyard, they all saw the forms of a huge cat and a baboon rise from the closed grating of the large cellar under the old dairy, rush past them, and disappear in a dark angle of the wall. The same figures were repeatedly seen afterwards by many other persons. Early in December of 1841, Mr. Bishop, hearing fearful screams accompanied by deep and hoarse jabberings, apparently coming from the top of the house, rushed upstairs, but as he reached the landing, all was instantly silent, and he could discover nothing. After that, he set to work to get rid of the house, and was fortunate enough to find as a purchaser a retired colonel. But this man was soon scared out of it too, and in 1842 the house was abandoned. It was later pulled down and the ground used for the erection of cottages, but the hauntings then transferred to them, scaring people almost out of their wits. The cottages were speedily vacated, and no one ever daring to inhabit them, they were eventually demolished and the site turned over for allotments. There were many theories as to the history of the Swallows, one being that a highwayman known as Steeplechase Jock, the son of a Scottish chieftain, had once plied his trade there and murdered many people whose bodies were supposed to be buried somewhere on or near the premises. He was said to have met a terrible and decidedly unorthodox end by falling into a vat of boiling tar. The second haunting of long ago concerns that of a ghost bird, an enormous raven, and it is certainly one of the oddest and most fascinating bird hauntings to have occurred anywhere. There was much excitement when about 1749 word spread that the three large vaults under the parish church of West Drayton near Uxbridge were haunted. In one vault, the family of Paget were interred, and in another, the even more ancient family of de Burgh. People passing by the church at night, more especially on a Friday night, swore that they heard knockings coming from the vaults. No very satisfactory explanation of the noises were ever given, but as the remains of a murderer who had committed suicide and the remains of his victims were buried together in one of the vaults, many believed that the knockings were thus accounted for the spirit of the murderer and the murdered were unwilling that their bodies should lie side by side. But then events took a different turn. One night, some people living close to the church heard dreadful screams coming from it. They hurried off to see the cause, and finding, on their arrival at the church, that the screams came from one of the vaults, they peered into it through the ventilation grating. They then saw just inside the vault an enormous raven that pecked at the coffins furiously, and all the while it did so, the screaming continued. Among the many witnesses were the sexton and his wife and a churchwarden. This story of the raven was confirmed by other people, including the wife of the parish clerk and her daughter, who testified to also seeing it in the church itself. One evening, a youth went to the local bell ringers, who had emphatically denied that the bird was a phantom at all, and told them that it was flying about in the chancel. Four of them, taking sticks and a lantern, then ran to the church to try to catch it. On reaching the church, they saw the bird, which was just as the youth described it, an enormous black bird fluttering about the chancel. They at once gave chase, and on one of the men striking it with a stick, it fell down screaming, apparently hurt. Believing that it was at last cornered, the man who had struck it was about to pick it up when, to the amazement of them all, it was found that the bird had vanished. After that, it was often to be seen either perched on the communion rails of the sanctuary or flying about in one or other of the vaults. Whenever anyone attempted to catch it, it always mysteriously disappeared. The villagers firmly believed that the ghost bird was the restless and miserable spirit of a murderer who had committed suicide, and who, through family influence, instead of being put into a pit or a hole with a stake through his body at the crossroads by Harmondsworth, as was the sentence by law, had been buried in consecrated ground on the north side of the churchyard. This was also the strong view of a neighboring squire who saw the phantom bird. He was quite positive that it was the earthbound soul of the criminal whose family history was known to him. Mrs. de Burgh, wife of Mr. R. L. de Burgh, a later vicar of West Drayton, stated that in the 1850s she had often heard sounds in the church like the fluttering of some very large bird, and that these strange sounds always appeared to come from the chancel. As late as 1869, two women going into the church one Saturday afternoon to put some flowers on the communion table momentarily saw a huge black bird sitting on one of the pews. The haunting thus seems to have continued intermittently over a period of more than 100 years. Finally, some more animal ghosts of which I took note while touring Scotland many years ago. These apparently were ghost dogs, but not at all like the usual harmless domestic variety. The Argyll Island of Tiree, I was told, was much haunted. A beach on its northern shore called Cladagh, a Crogane, compromising about 1,500 acres of shingle, was at the time of my visit as wild and lonely a spot as one could find in the British Isles, and at night especially strongly suggested all kinds of horrors. One haunting in particular attracted much attention among the islanders. It was the haunting by a phantom in the form of a large black dog, of a somewhat similar species to the thrash and striker in Lancashire, the padfoot in Yorkshire, and the shuck in Norfolk and Cambridge. Several of the older inhabitants of Tiree, so they declared, had seen this phantom following them, and they believed that if it barked once or twice, all was well. But if it barked 3 times, it was a sure sign that it would overtake them, in which case they or someone very closely connected with them would die very shortly. The local folk told me that another ghost dog, very like this one in appearance, but not of the same nature, haunted Hynish Hill in the southwest of Tiree, while yet another haunted the rocky shore near Balvaig. My informants, however, assured me that something infinitely more horrible was to be seen and heard on a circuit rock close to Balvaig, known locally as the Gradoir. I asked them what it was, and they said, "Something naked, not unlike a human body in form, but with a very grotesque and wholly diabolical face. It was occasionally seen in broad daylight, though more often between 2 and 4 a.m., and its chief characteristic was antipathy to dogs. It was said that a dog belonging to a Tiree fisherman swam one morning to the rock and failed to return, and on a search being made for it was found lying on the rocks with all its skin scraped off, as if by long nails or talons. It was horribly mutilated and died in great agony shortly after being found. This hatred of dogs appears to be a striking feature of many of the Western Isle and West of Scotland ghosts. On the hills between Loch Tuath and Loch Quan, there is a spot reputed to be haunted by various species of ghosts that exhibit fiendish satisfaction in torturing not only dogs, but animals in general. Many stories declared to be authentic are told of those ghosts. The following is an example. A man was crossing the hills one day with his dog, a terrier, when he saw a tall woman with long yellow hair standing on the spot that was said to be haunted. At first he took her to be a material being, but on looking at her closely he noticed there was something peculiar and shadowy about her, something which made him realize that she was no creature of flesh and blood. When he first caught sight of her, his dog whined and showed fear, but on his approaching nearer it became angry and rushed at her, snarling savagely, at which she snatched it up in her arms and ran off with it, taking cover behind a rock. Being fond of his dog, the man, though frightened, ran after the ghost woman, and on looking behind the rock found his dog lying dead in a pool of blood. Handfuls of hair had been torn from its body and apparently had been strangled. There was no sign of the woman anywhere, nor any place near at hand in which she could possibly have hidden. In the opinion of those who were living in that locality, and whose forebears had lived there before them, the phantom woman was a ghost well known to be inimical to all living things, and who had haunted these hills for generations.